Pseudopod episode 166, October 30th, 2009. This week's story, Something There Is by Joe Nazaire. Welcome, my friends, to the show that never ends until it does, because it's All Hallows Eve and somewhere Michael Wincott is planning Devil's Night, even as across the world the killers sharpen their bizarre and iconic weapons, and young couples prepare to hook up at places with names like Devil's Point, and you'll definitely be murdered in a curious fashion if you snog here, Cove. Happy almost Halloween, everyone. I'm Alistair, your host, and this is quite definitely Pseudopod. Our story this week comes from Joe Nazaire, whose work has appeared in anthologies and magazines like Harvest Hill, Dead in Common, and Butcher Knives and Body Counts. Joe is a college professor specialising in the study of SF and gothic horror, and he has had literary criticism essays in venues ranging from the Journal of the Fantastic in the Arts to Extrapolation. He is, as you're about to find out, rather fond of Edgar Allan Poe and would like readers to remember one very important fact. In Poe's classic, The Cask of Amontillado, Montresor narrates the tale of his vengeance against Fortunato a full half century after it's happened. Our story picks up immediately from that point, and picks up on the hints of fear and remorse in Montresor's overtly brazen narrative. Your narrator this week is the mighty B.J. Harrison of Classic Tales, who, throughout October, has been reading a Henry James' The Turn of the Screw in four unabridged chapters. He also has an Edgar Allan Poe collection on Audible.com and the iTunes Music Store that contains The Telltale Heart and many more. So pull up a chair, ignore the raven at the window, and don't drink the Amontillado just yet, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Something There Is by Joe Nazaire. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Robert Frost, Mending Wall. Ever downward he descends, winding and winding into the hollowed depths. The corkscrewing staircase terminates at last, spills him into the long tunnel, torchless. He finds seeming antidote to the dark in the nitre-rife walls. Their encrustation casts a sallow glow throughout the catacombs, illuming the skeletal pilings lining both sides of the pathway. Oblivious, though, to his anonymous ancestors beside him, he presses forward. His pace and his pulse quicken in tandem as he glides along the damp ground, penetrates vault after vault, until abruptly, he's halted. The wall looms directly before him, blocking off the crypt's darkest heart. 11 tiers of amateur masonry, holding steadfast against time's weathering tides. Except, yes, there, toward the center, a missing stone has left the blackened gap in the edifice. He stands, staring at it for an indeterminate period. Then, belatedly sees his own hand reaching toward the breach. Panicked, he tries to will stasis to the mutinous appendage, which is arrested only by the sudden concussion. As if shelled from its far side, the wall explodes toward him, enveloping him in churning shadow. He thrashes like a drunken seaman in a maelstrom as the darkness floods his mouth, his nostrils, even the corners of his clenched eyes. All the while, the engulfing torrent sounds a single word inside his head, filling it with the same five siren syllables. Amontillado. Montresor lurched upright, sloughing the sodden bedclothes. He gasped for breath and tried to blink himself oriented. Still, he managed a falsetto shriek upon spotting the wizened jester at his bedside reaching toward him. Easy, old friend. The figure slurred the words slightly while pressing an assuring hand to Montresor's shoulder. Montresor's shock-addled brain needed a few minutes to identify the signore, keeping such surprising vigil. Lucchese? He spoke at last. Here, lie back. Lucchese guided Montresor back down to the nest of pillows. Just came to check on you, he explained. When I met one of your attendants in the streets tonight, he said you'd been ill with fever. The last word jogged scattered sickbed memories. "Afraid I haven't been myself lately," Montressor admitted, then paused to take in Lucchese's party-striped dress. "Nor do I seem to be the only one. What are you doing going around in such crazy costume?" The bells on Lucchese's conical cap jingled as he chuckled.
"So wrapped in your own delirium, eh, that you've missed the start of Carnival?"
"Ah, the supreme madness," Montressor replied, suddenly understanding. "I hadn't realized its season had come already." He glanced over towards the window of his bedchamber. Though day had dawned, tireless revelers could still be heard carrying on in the streets below. Montressor could easily imagine Lucchese numbered amongst the celebrants. As if reading Montressor's thoughts, Lucchese reached down toward his feet. His hand came back, proffering a long-necked bottle.
"Here,"
he spoke in a conspiratorial whisper, after shooting a look toward the palazzo's attendantless hallway.
"Medoc. Just what I happen to have handy with me, you understand? But it should serve as a worthy substitute."
"Substitute?"
"In your sleep just now, you were calling out for Amontillado."
Vestiges of his nightmare shrouded Montressor's thoughts. Dry-mouthed, he attempted to swallow nonetheless.
"You must have misheard me, I'm sure.
Please, no." Frowning, Montressor brushed aside the bottle held under his nose. Lucchese simply shrugged and helped himself to a drink. Montressor did not regret the curtness of his refusal. His companion should have more sense than to make such offer. While ignorant of the reason why, Lucchese knew full well that Montressor had lost the taste for such spirits 5 decades ago. In fact, the proud connoisseur had been the main buyer when Montressor promptly sold off all the casks and puncheons from his family vaults. Picturing those catacombs now drew Montressor back again to his troubled night's sleep, and the more vexing question of the cause of his recent unrest. Montressor darted his gaze across the room to his escritoire, a finely crafted piece he'd imported from Paris many years earlier. There, in its locked drawer, lay the days-old pages upon which he'd finally recorded his vengeance 50 years post-facto. Presently, Montressor had to wonder if his quill and not his trowel had perpetrated the true crime. He'd been plagued by ill health and worse dreams, seemingly ever since inking those bold words, as if the actual scripting of the tale had summoned guilt's long-dormant demons from the pit of his mind. Montressor swung his view back over to his visitor.
"Tell me, have you ever wondered what really happened to our old acquaintance?"
As Lucchese's heavy-lidded eyes narrowed further in puzzlement, Montressor elaborated.
"Who went missing and whose body never turned up?"
For some reason he hesitated to voice the name outright.
"That fool? Surely his bones litter the riverbed to this day."
Lucchese waved a dismissive hand as he alluded to the once popular theory that the missing nobleman had stumbled and drowned during Carnival.
"Not that I ever cared enough myself to go dredging. Too busy burying my tool in his widow, eh? It seems my tastes were a match for Fortunato's after all."
Lucchese gave a hearty laugh, his eyes momentarily twinkling with what Montressor assumed was the memory of past debauchery. Montressor himself could only force a weak smile for his friend. The septuagenarian jester rambled on.
"No surprise if Fortunato's footing betrayed him. Well, you both know he already had a tongue made too slippery by drink."
Lucchese, though, apparently was not too tipsy to forget tact. He came no closer than that to referencing Fortunato's notorious slights of the Montressor family.
"But what makes you waste thought now on that long-dead wretch?"
"The Amontillado." The unspoken words sloshed in Montressor's ear, ravaging his equilibrium. He tried to shake his head clear of the echo.
I fear my own death," he muttered at last. "What? Nonsense! It's only a touch of fever.
Lucchese gave a sniff toward the bed, wrinkling his nose in mock disgust.
And you seem to have done a fine job of sweating it all out.
No, Montressor stammered. What I mean is enough of this, Lucchese cut him off, as if such talk were an affront to the season.
You're fine. You just need to get up and ambulate.
Lucchese himself rose from his bedside seat, patted Montressor's arm.
Why don't I call on you again tonight, and we'll go out and celebrate Carnival?
No, I couldn't. Lucchese ignored the plea as he headed toward the doorway.
If you won't join me in drink, then at least we can feast together. We'll find some young lovelies to ogle and even more drunken ones to fondle.
He paused and turned back, sporting an impish grin.
And should all that excitement somehow prove the death of a couple of old lechers like us, why, we'll just caper our way right down to merry hell. Till later, old friend.
Lucchese lifted the strangled wine bottle in salute and exited. Despite his own weariness, Montressor could not help but be buoyed by Lucchese's spirited nature. Perhaps the man was right. It was Carnival, after all, a time for shucking off the burden of yesterdays and living for the here and now. Montressor would do well to stop dwelling on the long-buried past, to get out of this bed and to get life flowing back into his limbs. Resolved to do just that, he moved to untangle himself from the bedclothes, and then froze. For the love of God. Looking down on the backs of his suddenly shaking hands, Montressor spotted the scabrous abrasions on his knuckles and the crescents of grime caked under the ragged edges of his fingernails. Montressor had worked his way deep into the labyrinthine cavern of leering skulls and pointing limbs before he even realized that he stood barefoot and barely dressed. No matter. If his fears were confirmed, then such ill-clad ambling was nothing new for him. He pressed on, arm extended. The catacomb's nitrous atmosphere dulled his flambeau's luminescence to an eerie glow. Even pitch blackness might not have prevented his passage, though. The very muscles of his legs seemed to know the twisting route by rote. The steadily sloping descent carried him through a series of low arches, until finally he found himself in the sought-after crypt. Tremors beset Montressor's hands the moment he entered, complicating his attempt to set his torch in the sconce alongside the threshold. For in that instant of arrival, he'd had plenty of time to glean that the ramparts of bones he directed long ago at the far end of the chamber had since been tossed aside. Reluctantly, Montressor traversed the crypt, sensing for the first time the chilling dampness of his family vaults. The lump he bore in his throat seemed to cut off his breath as he approached the exposed rear wall. He could only snort his dismay upon closing in and spotting the state of the mason work. The wall hardly stood inviolate. Fist-sized gaps pocked its surface, pitch-black portals into its inner secrets. Haphazard stones bulged like herniated organs on the formerly flat plain. Surely something more intemperate than time had been beating against this barrier. Montressor dropped his gaze to his bruised and dirtied fingers, then lifted it back to the faltering wall. How much of this was his own, if only somnambulistic, handiwork? No wonder he'd been bedridden in recent days, if this was where he'd been spending his nights. Unease enfolded him like a roquelaire as Montressor tried to fathom what exactly had been drawing him down in such nocturnal journey. Standing there now, he was certain of only one thing. In its current decadence, the wall formed an abomination. It was like some rough, itching scab that needed to be picked, and Montressor doubted he would know a moment's peace until he did so. As the ensconced torch flickered behind him, wispy shadows slithered across the wall in front of him. For a moment, he imagined that the shadows were being sucked into the wall, the various apertures forming a host of greedy mouths. The impression unnerved him and spurred him into action. With a shrill scream, he launched himself, pounding and clawing at the wall. Amidst his frenzy, he could feel his fingernails bending sharply backwards. They did not snap off, though, because the wall proved surprisingly pliable. It was as if the unremittingly dank atmosphere of the catacombs had somehow transmuted stone and mortar into a sludgy mush. Finding purchase in the existing holes, Montressor began to tear away sizable clumps of the formation. He was too exhilarated over finally attacking it in full, wakeful force to even marvel at the cataclysmic results. Before he realized it, the wall was no more, its materials strewn across the cold floor of the crypt. Montressor surveyed the damage, his lips curling into an appreciative smile, even as his gaunt chest heaved. He felt utterly relieved, rid at last of some infernal weight that had been pressing down on him. For several glorious moments he drank in the spectacle of the wall's ruination, before turning his attention to what he'd uncovered. The niche had been created by the pair of colossal supports that stretched up the back wall of solid granite and pressed up against the vaulted ceiling. The resultant recess measured a mere 4 feet deep, 3 feet wide, and 6 or 7 high. These dimensions framed the macabre tableau within, the slouching figure of Fortunato. Or at least the skeleton thereof, the bones dun-colored and dusted with ancient decay. The chain that had bound the erstwhile jester, like some parody of Prometheus, now hung loose as a sash across the fleshless chest and ribcage. 50 intervening years had meanwhile bleached the color from his motley dress, had eroded it to a tattered rag. The fool's capped skull had tilted forward, as if Fortunato stared continually dumbfounded down at his own predicament. Montressor stood, eyeing his mortified nemesis. "Free at last," he pronounced in creaking voice. Fortunato remained speechless, which only served to loosen Montressor's own tongue. "What? This is what you wanted? No? Then why do you wait? Perhaps a helping hand?" Montressor seized Fortunato's slender neck, snatching him forward from the niche. "Go then," he shrieked. "Off to whatever hell or hell-raising beckons you!" But instantly upon disturbance, the skeleton lost its tenuous structure, its outline of former manhood. Fortunato deconstructed into a bony jumble upon the crypt floor, and Montressor found himself holding only a hollow skull. He ventured no poor Yorick soliloquies, quickly tossing the thing like a hot coal. Bells jingled as the head rolled, and then kept on ringing after the skull bounced to a halt. Now Montressor was the one dumbfounded. With his own eyes, he could see the discarded cap lying motionless, yet somehow the bells persisted. If anything, they increased in pitch. Their metallic rattle reverberated off the walls, seemed to amplify every last trickle of moisture from the riverbed above the catacombs. The din grew toothache sharp, and Montressor spun around trying to pinpoint its source. No such luck. The impossible noise rang on all sides of him at once. Dizzily, he clapped his hands to his ears, then reversed such gesture within seconds, unable to stand the terrible warble trapped inside his head. When he staggered off whimpering, the merciless jingling trailed him through the crypt. Bells, 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 they chimed a paean to torment as Montressor surfaced into his palazzo. His own maddened cries could do nothing to drown them out. The tintinnabulation continued, even as he chased off his handful of confusedly fawning attendants. When he tried to bury his head under his pillows, a tinkling ghost cap seemed to slide right under with him. The cacophony dogged him for the remainder of the day, scrambling all thought until eventually driving him to his ultimate determination. Only when he moved to execute the plan did the enveloping jangle seem to slacken. Did not stop altogether, just softened, as if in encouragement of his chosen course. So now, having gathered and transported the fresh materials, Montressor found himself standing once more before the exposed niche in the deepest reaches of the catacombs. It felt like decades rather than hours since his ordeal had begun. He paused in momentary contemplation. But then the bells rang in piercing knell and prodded him into action. The long-lying trowel that had sealed Fortunato's fate now wore a coat of rust, but the tool proved trusty enough to spread the fresh mortar. Montressor fought off a devastating sense of déjà vu as he set to the task of laying the tiers of building stone. Really, though, the experience differed this time around, proved more arduous, and not just because he was 50 years the worse for wear. He fought for elbow room within the cramped workspace, struggled to lift and maneuver the strategically piled pieces into place. Then there was the inevitable loss of light to contend with, leaving him to proceed practically blindly. Still, he plastered, undeterred, even as the foul air choked phlegm-laced coughs from him. All things considered, he was doing a damn fine job of walling himself in. The wall had been raised to 10 tiers, with room for one more, when Montressor suddenly realized what he'd achieved. Blessed silence. He tossed aside the trowel in exultation, relished the serenity he had banked on. Languor set in almost instantly. Montressor drew cognizant of the fatigue saturating his body, as the cessation of the bells meanwhile worked on him like some mellifluous lullaby. Unable and unwilling to resist, he sank down within the enclosure and drifted off into heavy, dreamless slumber. He woke to darkness, the flambeau on the far side of the wall having long since guttered out. So black were his surroundings that the resurrected wall almost seemed non-existent. Tentatively, he stretched his fingers in verifying touch and brushed the frigid stone. Feeling the barrier in front of him somehow heightened his sense of the pair of supports flanking him and of the granite wall at his back. Hugging his knees, he imagined these barriers slowly closing inward and compressing the dark into greater density. But even if his eyesight wouldn't, his mind gradually adjusted to the encompassing opacity. He managed to relax, settling back and counting his blessings. After all, he'd succeeded in walling out the harrying clamor, and despite his recent illness and current environs, he didn't feel the faintest hint of a cough scratching at his throat. Yes, this was suitable sanctuary indeed. The privacy more important than any privation. Montressor took solace in the fact that whatever time remained to him, be it measured in minutes or days, would be spent with him resting in peace. No sooner did the thought cross his mind than the tremors started, an unearthly quaking whose epicenter lay deep within him. When Montressor tried to voice his fright over the abrupt quivering, he discovered that his tongue and throat had turned bone dry. His convulsion was outstripped by a singular compulsion, but strangely, water did not represent the quenching liquid desired. Montressor's spirits drained into the abyss of his chest as he sensed a delirium other than fever bedeviling him. No. What more could be asked of him? Surely he had mended the rift, leveling the wall and then rebuilding it with himself inside. Yet as he was now forced to recall what had once lured Fortunato down to this site. The Amontillado. Yes, the Amontillado. Montressor realized that the issue at stake had never been atonement. It had been appeasement. The denied draft from the fancied cask, Fortunato's dying wish devolving into eternal want. Thereafter, a most carnivalesque curse must have riddled this tomb, the overwhelming desire for drink filling the unhallowed space like some wretched effluvium. Montressor's own burgeoning craving for the absent Amontillado grew incrementally unbearable. His mouth felt as if it raged with stinging fire ants that only liquor could douse. As hoary memories of bygone imbibing plagued him, he His very being seemed to curl in awful withdrawal. From his knees, Montressor tried to beat an escape through the enclosing wall. The mortar had long since dried, though, clutching the stones in impervious grip. Heedless of any pain as his knuckles were driven back into his fists, Montressor indulged in festering hatred for his own handiwork. He continued, screeching, until suddenly he froze mid-wail. Dear God, was there something? He wanted, so desperately he wanted, to believe that his frenzied movements had merely jostled the stapled chain hanging on the wall behind him. But what he truly feared to have heard, nearby, on the opposite side of the wall that fenced him in, was derisive laughter intermingled with tinkling bells. The latest affront trumped the 1,000 other injuries Montressor had suffered in his lifetime. The half-century legacy of his masonry fell over him like a pall as he belatedly grasped what a wall such as this was bound to create. Anything but separation. He felt shards of stone, or perhaps even bone, biting into his bare heels as he stretched himself upright. Breathless, he flattened himself up against the wall that rose to just below eye level. He pressed his gaze into the crypt in dreadful search for a neighbor waiting in the darkness beyond.
Halloween, that night where everything seems possible, where the past and the present collide and all the old ghosts come out to play. The night where we close the curtains early, the night where we make sure the pumpkins are lit, and the night where every year, the long war between children and their teeth steps up to DEFCON 1. But it's the ghosts I keep coming back to, the parade of ideas and people who are gone but not forgotten. I can't shake the idea of a macabre carnival at this time of year. A long procession. An ascension of man for horror that begins with Pliny the Younger talking excitedly about the story he's just written about a haunted house. After him come the 9th Hispano Legion, never quite home and never quite anywhere else, followed by the Headless Horsemen, the Reapers and the Spring-Heeled Jacks, the figures who stalked the landscape and left nothing but death in their wake, even though somehow the story always survives. Then the doomed lovers, cycling endlessly through reunion, redemption, bloody murder, bloody suicide, bloody vengeance, and back again. The women in white and the women in black, who dance with each other at least as much as with the men with no heads, and the soldiers, lost and forgotten in the fog of war. The people from Arkham County, with the strange eyes and the gruff voices, come next, followed by the scientist spiritualists, their banner one of Carnacki's old electric pentagrams shining neon blue. After them come the endless ranks of serial killers, arguing as they always do and always will about why so many of them are dressed like Scream or Saw, whilst behind them the little girls with hair over their faces dance and play in staccato, fast-forward movements that are never quite human and never quite still. The Mothmen come next. No one makes eye contact with them. No one can. Then the ghosts, the true ghosts, flickering in and out like images half caught on film. Normal people, as beautiful and awful as that phrase suggests, each one unique, each one dead, each one aware of that. Some of them disappear into light or dark, as they always do, but more take their place, as they always do. They're shepherded along by two women, one with long dark hair, one with blonde. Both have their families with them, although there's something rather odd about the dark-haired one's husband. Then the hunters arrive, and the parade comes to life. At their head are a group of people with the easy familiarity you only get when you grow up together. The blonde woman with the stake looks a little uncomfortable, but her red-headed friend can't stop smiling and waving, whilst the young man with the eye patch next to her is grinning so broadly it looks like his head will split. On the other side of her, the three men in trench coats are a study in contrasts. The dark-haired one in the centre looks grim. The blonde one next to him keeps vamping out and striking rockstar poses, and the blonde one on the other side of him, shorter, slighter, more mortal than the other two, lights a cigarette and smiles. Behind them, the older man with glasses he can't stop playing with mutters something under his breath. The woman in the leather jacket next to him laughs the dirtiest laugh in the world, echoed by the tall, bald black man to his right. but his laugh doesn't reach his eyes. They're still watching the blonde vampire in front of him, and always will be. Then, Highway to Hell by AC/DC reaches full volume, and the 67 Chevy Impala slinks into view. It's a beautiful car, and it knows it. Sleek and black and low-slung and coiled like a spring. The young man driving it is pounding away on the steering wheel, air-drumming like a maniac and singing along, whilst his brother, the one with the longer, dark hair, looks out of the window and broods. He's good at that. In the back seat, an angel in a crumpled suit looks a little confused and doesn't notice that his finger is tapping along with the beat. After them is silence, but not absence. Something moves out in the dark. Something unformed and shapeless, but ready. Slouching towards Jerusalem, waiting to be born. To become next year's horror. To become next year's threat. But that doesn't matter, because tomorrow night is Halloween. Tomorrow night the parade goes by and we light our lanterns and we watch, because tomorrow night is Halloween. That's what we do. Happy Halloween, everyone. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated, is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and Pseudopod is powered entirely by your donations. If you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. Our closing music is by Helpful Machines. Find out more about them at helpfulmachines.net. Pseudopod wants you to remember, it can't rain all the time.